My name's Seth Gould, and I'm a metalsmith and toolmaker from Bakersville, North Carolina. Welcome to Cut the Craft.
I just had a genius idea. What if Goodwill sold large Kleenex boxes filled with a certain size of shirt? Or like a certain size of shorts. And then you have them in the shop. And then you can just like pull out your next shirt out of the box.
That would be pretty nice.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
I do. My rags basically come in like a Kleenex box. So it's pretty nice.
See? Mine are always like old bed sheets. I can't throw away anything. So like at the very worst, they like... Or like the very last stage of like any piece of clothing that I own ends up in like my little like rag pile.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. Actually have a fitted sheet that I need to cut up.
That's what I'm working through right now.
Are you serious? Oh my gosh. We are like the same.
Does yours have green stripes?
No, it's like.
Does yours have green stripes?
Tan. It's this tan color. It matches Willow's hair. Color so that I don't have to feel like everything is covered in Willow's hair. I just can't tell.
Willow's Amy's dog.
Oh yeah, it's my dog. So you know. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's get started, Brian.
All right. Welcome to Cut the Craft, everybody. I'm Brian.
And I'm Amy.
And we are here with toolmaker and metalsmith Seth Gould. Seth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys very much for inviting me to be on.
Yes. So
excited. We're very excited.
We're super excited.
Yes.
So Seth, can you tell us what you make and a little bit about your work and process?
Sure, yeah. So I make a lot of different things, but pretty much everything is a utilitarian object, and it kind of ranges from simple tools to like highly embellished locks and boxes. Hmm. And most everything I make starts in a coal fire and starts from raw material or bar stock. And I forge it as close to the finished shape as I can, using hammer, anvil, power hammer, whatever means. And after that, it cools off and I bring it to my bench and clamp it in a vise and start filing away. And most everything I make is finished with a file finish.
What?
Ooh.
There's a lot of other things too. I mean, that's not it. That's the abridged version.
And zip, zap, zap, it's done.
That totally takes 5 minutes.
Well, so, I mean, for, I guess, people who might not be very well acquainted with the metal world, when you say file finish, you mean you're using like a little hand file and that the surface that leaves after a stroke with the file is the final surface of like the piece rather than like, you know, sandpaper or whatever.
Right. Right. I really don't enjoy sanding, so I choose not to sand things. No, I mean, it's definitely a certain look. It takes it from the forged object, which is black coming out of the fire, and then you file away the black oxide, and it turns bright, a silver color. And so it's got that kind of beautiful silver finish, and then by using a variety of different files, coarse to fine, I can get a really nice, smooth, even finish on it.
Dang. But that takes like a ridiculous amount of like control, right? Because I mean, I just know from making the little brass stamps that I do, if you're not really careful and aren't holding the file in the exact same sort of like angle, it can totally, you know, the difference between like really, really good filing and really, really bad filing isn't that far. Like just like the tiniest angle.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It has a lot. And like when I work with people and teach classes, it's like it's a big learning curve. There's a lot of nuance to that. I mean, I think people get, first off, I think people get scared of filing or are frustrated by filing because they mostly are used to using dull files that are just kicking around a shop or that they're grandfather handed down to him or what have you. And so to like, first off, to be using a really sharp new file makes it a much more enjoyable process. And then once you get through the beginning stages of anything that you're new at, once you get some control and understanding of what you're doing, you can create a really nice flat surface. But yeah, totally. I mean, it's not far from something looking off to something looking really crisp. It's just getting that control down.
Cool. Do you have a favorite file?
No, I don't have a favorite file. I mean, I definitely have files that I go to more often than others.
That's good. That was a fatherhood question and you passed. I don't know if you're planning on having multiple kids, but
I love all my files equally.
Oh, I get it.
I have a question because like you, so when I was at Penland, I saw the big like trunk. Is that what it was?
Yeah,
all I remember is like how big it was. How were you? Mm-hmm. Did you file like the panels on that? I'm just like totally mind boggled by the amount of work.
Before you answer that, would you describe Seth a little bit what that piece is about the coffer? And then also, yes.
Sure. I guess like a little bit of a backstory or setup for it is that, in 2018, I finished my 3-year residency at the Penland School of Craft, which is a opportunity that you can apply for where you get to live at the school, you get an empty studio, you are provided housing and like partial meals at the dining hall, and you basically get to live and work in the Penland community. And so as part of that application, I was intending to try and make some work that was much larger, much more involved, and kind of long story short was that this coffer kind of ended up embodying all of that. So I made this piece. It's very much inspired by historical examples.
Cool.
It's a box. It looks like it is a chest. It's about 24 inches wide and 18 inches deep and about that tall as well. And it's all made out of steel. And so to your question, Amy, yes, pretty much every part of that was forged and then filed to finish. Asked about the panels, the outside of it. That was sheet that I did not forge out that sheet, but I did put a file finish on it to kind of match the.
How does that work? Like, are you holding it flat and just kind of pulling it?
I
had to figure that one out. I ended up basically fixing it to a tabletop and using large files across the top of it. And I should mention it's a locked box, so it's a pretty complicated unlocking procedure where you have to go through about a dozen tricks in order to just be able to put the key in and then turn the lock, which is made out of several. What is it? It's a dozen bolts that pull back at the same time.
Jeez.
To be able to unlock the lid.
Well, I think saying, quote unquote, it's pretty complicated is probably an insane, not probably, it is an insane understatement. I mean, I watched your progress pictures unfold as you built this thing, and it's like it's just like ridiculous. And then there are all these components that you can't even see that all have these like beautiful little like flourishes and stuff like that. Like, I mean, didn't you make every screw or every bolt?
I made every screw. Mm-hmm.
Did you?
Whoa!
Even with like all the screws, are all the screws hand tapped and everything? Like, you didn't put them in a metal lathe or anything?
No, so I did. Yeah, I used a lathe to cut the screws. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Whoa. Man,
I just can't believe it. Like I have like a secret like craft crush on like metal lathe stuff and like machinists' work, mostly because
it's amazing.
It's amazing. Like, it's totally, I'm like, wait, you can make your own screws and stuff? Like, what the heck? That's so cool. Like, and I just, the level of precision that, like, first of all, just a lathe, like the machinists, I feel like are kind of like crazy with the level of precision, and they all have to be, obviously. But like the fact that you're able to be in my opinion, you know, lay person's opinion, like as precise and exacting with a file is just like, I'm just like totally blown away by that. I looked at that coffer and I was just like, whoa, this guy, like I can't, like I know how much work it would be just to do that with all the machinist sort of tools. And then to hear that you're hand filing everything is just like.
Well, I think it's actually, it's kind of, I think people get skewed with that perception though, because I actually find it's all about how you approach the making process. And so I find that I can actually make things more precise through filing than I can with a machine.
Oh, interesting.
And so that's all like people will take that statement in different ways, but like how that comes from me is that when I make something, I make one piece that then fits the next. It's not like no one of those screws in that coffer can be put in a different screw hole and it be right. Everything is fit to where it goes. And so then to actually like fit one part to the other, I can do that faster than making like a whole batch of things. But that also goes towards the conversation, how I prefer to work. Like I'd prefer to work in that way than standing at a machine or, you know, going to the even other extreme and to like CNC and things like that. Like,
yeah,
has a lot more programming involved where it's like, I'd rather stand at a bench with a file.
Right.
Sure.
That makes sense. I mean, I think that is sort of my approach to woodworking too. Cause I just get more and more, like I get smaller and more precise and like make all these little like triangular things and paint them and like all this stuff. And people are always questioning me, how do you, you know, do you have a pattern that you do? And it's like, no, I really just eyeball it and it looks okay.
I have a pair of glasses.
I've got some glasses. Yeah. And the string that I use, like, which is true, but I think that makes sense to me that it's more just about like how you work.
Yeah. Yeah. And while I was at Penland, because, the shop is open to the public, kind of like, you know, if there's a visitor coming through the school, they're welcome to come through the resident artist studio. So with students coming through all the time and things like that, I ended up talking to people about this piece a lot because I worked on it for almost the entire 3 years. Mm-hmm. And a term that just kind of naturally came out of this was perceived precision. And through talking about it, I kind of realized that was a good way to describe what I was doing, where things do look really precise and really accurate as if they were all, you know, cranked out on machinery, but it's actually just the perception of that. Because like I said, it's your perception of precision. Does precision mean everything needs to fit exactly everything else? Or is it just this one thing that's this or this one?
Yeah. Right.
That, you know,
that's really interesting. I really, really like that term because I think it's sort of, I'm thinking of it in terms of like the book world where you look at the tooled patterns on like a historic book and in many ways you would look at it and be like, I would say it's perceived precision. You look at it from a distance and it's like this crazy ornate pattern. You're like, how could they ever do that? And then you look at it up close and like things are a little wiggly or like maybe they missed an impression over here. And
there's so much metalwork that's like that. And I had that same realization at some point and it was really freeing.
Well, I mean maybe it's a lot of it's just because you're, you know, like you said, it's like each piece you make fits the, you know, and fits the previous one and then lays the groundwork for the next one. And so it's like as long as you're just reasonably careful about that junction and that it does what you need it to do, it's like it'll end up, you know, adding up to something that looks like it was all this like crazy perfect 90 degree perfection.
Totally, yeah.
That's super cool. Thanks.
Yeah, I think the nuance of it not being quote unquote perfect is far more interesting than if it were perfect.
Totally.
Yeah. That's actually something that just reminded me of something David Pye said in the Nature and Art of Workmanship. About the like comparing the move. I can't remember the exact word that he used, but it's something akin to like the movement that happens in something that's handmade. Whereas if everything's manufactured, they're all singing the same note. And so like this, this big difference between like totally like perfectly manufactured cars on a street corner and, you know, I don't know, something else that's not completely
a Model T.
Yeah. Model T that was like hammered out by your great grandpa. But like, yeah, there is a difference. There's a lot more life and a lot more movement in something that has been manufactured to itself rather than, stamped out basically. And he talks a little bit about that.
Interesting. Yeah, I agree.
It's also very reassuring to learn that there are little imperfections in your work.
Just don't look at us.
We were both worried. We were like, oh man, like, how are we going to live up to that?
How funny would it be if we were like, oh, we want to meet the artist, and then like a robot comes around the corner. We're just like, hey.
Well, how unnerving would it be if I just came on here and was like, no, everything I make is perfect.
Oh, right? That's so true. Oh, whoa. Also, I know you're not a robot. You're a very nice and real person.
Make me a robot.
Oh, well, okay. So Seth, what first got you interested in metalwork and what keeps you going?
Well, I went to college. I went to an art college and I thought I was going to be a graphic designer or illustrator. And I was introduced to the metalsmithing department there. It's kind of as simple as that. I took a metalsmithing class and really fell in love. I was taking woodworking classes too, really loved those too. But the working in metal really kind of sparked something in me that I didn't realize was there. And that sounds kind of cheesy, but it's kind of interesting because my family's business is automotive repair, and I never was terribly interested in that, but kind of my whole family, and especially my grandfather, was very precise. Like, it was the cleanest kept shop that anyone had ever seen. You know, things were unbelievably orderly, and like my father and uncle and mom all have like really incredible work ethics, which I feel very fortunate that they passed on to me or taught me. And then it was when I started working with metal that like some of those more precise tendencies started to come out. And so it really just kind of, I felt like it clicked.
Wow.
Whoa. Nurture and nature, baby.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
Well, so on that note, then like what keeps you going? Cause I know sometimes you do these like larger ish batches of hand tools, say some like dividers or calipers, or hammers. But then also sometimes you do these like multiple year spanning projects where every component is sort of like its own different thing.
So what keeps me going is the education, like is learning something, the yearning to know more and always try and better the next piece, or better my technique, or learn a new technique, work in a new material. You know, it's always about progressing in the studio. That's what I would say keeps me going. And then in terms, I guess, like you mentioned, I'll do like a batch of tools versus a more involved project. So I kind of look at those as two separate sides of my business or of my shop or studio practice, whatever you want to call it. And so the tools, you know, there's a little bit less learning on that side, a little bit less progression. I mean, I'm always trying to make the next batch better and better. But a lot of times those are financially supporting the rest of the work, because that other work, you know, is not going to sell immediately necessarily.
Sure.
So that side of my business is much more about the passion and interest.
No, that's super fascinating too, because two of the things you said reminded me of two different interviews we've had. One of them was that we talked with Wita Vincent, who's a hobby woodworker and then also like a medical doctor primarily.
Okay.
And she spent a lot of time looking into personal finance. And so we were kind of picking her brain a little bit, just being like, well, if someone wants to do this, like, you know, any kind of craft for a living, what would you advise? And she was like, multiple streams of income. Like, you got to do a few different things to, you know, mm-hmm. if something dries up or you're waiting on this, then you can still sort of rely on that. So
yeah.
I think that's like a perfect testament to that.
Definitely.
And then you also mentioned that when you were, you know, going to art school, which you went to art school in Maine, correct?
Yeah, I went to the Maine College of Art.
Okay, cool. And so you mentioned, though, that you originally thought you were going to go in and be like a graphic designer. And would you say that that was sort of your assumption going into the program, that that was the only way you could really like make a living in the arts as a field, sort of? The reason I ask that is because we talked to Corey Pemberton, who's glass. Well, you know Corey, I'm assuming, from Pentland as well. Yeah, so he was saying when he went to, I think, VCU down in Virginia, that he was like, yeah, I went, you know, I was in the art department. I thought I was going to be a graphic designer because I sort of operated under the myth that that was the only way you could make a living in art. So that was what I was going to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's not far off, I'd say. I mean, I think it probably comes from the fact that it was the only thing, you know, one of the few things that was, that I knew was a profession, you know?
Mm, right.
I didn't, like, I wasn't particularly interested in going to school to be a sculptor. That didn't, you know, I didn't think of that as a profession. And that's being totally naive at that age, of course.
Sure.
But same thing with the metalsmithing. I didn't know metalsmithing was a thing that you could do.
Yeah.
You know? Right. Like, I obviously grew up in my parents' garage and, like, knew, like, was around metal and tools and all that all the time. But that was through fixing cars.
Yeah. Right. So. Yeah. No, that's, I just think that's really interesting. It's sort of like, and not to hate on graphic designers. Like, for instance, we love Brad Vetter, who's our graphic designer for the podcast, but, I don't mean to do that at all, but it does seem to be like the kind of like when you're people like list careers and then you're just like, oh, doctor, lawyer, business person. Graphic designer, like graphic designers, like the only one that comes in your head is like a viable, like art profession. It's not like businessman.
Oh, I feel like bookbinder's right up there too. That gets
right. Yeah, oh, that goes with professional popper is right. The next one.
Popper. What's that? I don't even know what that is.
You know, like a popper, like a PAU.
Oh, I was like, I thought it was
not
thinking,
like a jalapeno popper.
Yeah, I was like a jalapeno popper. Like, what are you talking about?
Now that's a profession I could get behind.
Yeah. Professional jalapeno popper eater.
The John C. Campbell Folk School, based in Brasstown, North Carolina, has virtual options for you in various arts, so you can temper your craft touch on top of fueling the fire of your mood with us. They've been forging craft knowledge forward for nearly 100 years, and in this socially distanced epoch, they want to keep those nerves in your body alert, add some color to your time, and brighten your mind with weekend and week-long classes until in-person meetings on their campus can happen once again. You can find them through whatever search engine you prefer, many social media outlets, and our website.
So, Seth, can you tell us a little bit about your travels in Europe and Japan? And
yes,
what was different or similar in those two approaches to metalsmithing?
Yeah, I got to travel in both places. The first time... Well, Europe was very early on, and it's kind of a whole story of how I ended up in Europe. But I guess what's relevant for this is that I ended up at a museum in Rouen, France. And this was right after college. The museum was called Le Sec de Tournelle. And so this was right after college, and I'd been exposed to metalsmithing and thought it was what I wanted to do, but mostly I'd just been exposed to forging and blacksmithing in the form of architectural work. And so going to this museum in Rouen, it was just filled with all these objects, mostly utilitarian objects that were meticulously made, just totally incredibly refined and all made out of iron. And so that really kind of changed the way I looked at iron work, because I loved all the meticulousness that the fine metals department had taught me in terms of more in the line of goldsmithing and silversmithing, Mm-hmm. And then I'd been introduced to forging, but I didn't really know how those things were going to meet up. And so seeing this work in this museum, which did include a lot of locks and all sorts of incredible things, that really helped connect those two. And then in Japan, as for Japan, I went to Japan on two separate trips. And both times I traveled there with Hiroko Yamada, who I met while taking a class at Penland. And at that time, she was my teacher, but since then has become a dear friend. And I just can't even express how thankful I am for her to help me get there and be there with me on those trips. Like luckily, amazingly, it was a twice in a lifetime experience for me.
cool.
I'm so fortunate for her. And she's just so gracious and wonderful. Anyway. I went there the first time. It was kind of a whirlwind tour for 2 weeks, and we toured around and just met all these Japanese metalsmiths, and went to some museums, and it really opened my eyes to the non-ferrous side of Japanese metalwork. I wasn't really there looking at any blacksmithing. And then a few years later, I got to go back. I applied for a study abroad grant and got to go back for longer and study with several of those artists that I met and work
Whoa.
With
them learning their craft.
So those were the Japan and Europe. And in terms of them being, I guess, similar or different, they're kind of totally different in the European work. I'm most interested in the iron work and the Japanese metalwork. I'm most interested in the non-ferrous metalwork mm-hmm. and the ornamentation, types of ornamentation they do, inlay, engraving, overlay, the way they patina their metals, the different kinds of metals they use. Because they have some really unique alloys of metals that we don't use so much in the Western world. I mean, more so now because of the world being as open as it is. But for a long time, they just had these really unique materials that only they had.
And when you say non-ferrous, that's just meaning it not iron containing, correct?
Yep.
Correct?
Yep.
Okay, so, cool.
Brass, copper, gold, silver, gold, yep. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay, great.
When you're working with those two different metals, do you have to, I know that I'm showing my like ignorance here, but so with like inlay and that kind of stuff, do you have to like weld those two different metals together somehow? How do you get brass to stay in iron? Is it just a matter of making it so precise that it just doesn't want to leave? Or do you have to?
I really like the way you put that. I would call that inlay. there's many different ways of joining metals together. I mean, you can weld two metals together. You can solder them together using a dissimilar metal that basically acts as like a glue to bond them together.
Could you, when you're explaining those, and if you wouldn't mind starting from welding again, just sort of explain the basic concept behind each one.
Sure. Yeah. So welding, you're normally welding two of the same material together for the most part, except in some odd circumstances. And so then you're heating both metals up and adding in a filler material or you're fusing. There's many different kinds of welding. Like when I forge weld in the coal forge, I heat two pieces of iron up and heat them up to a really hot temperature. And then when I hammer them together, they actually will fuse to each other. And then there's many different kinds of electric welding, TIG welding, MIG welding. And so for the most part, those are joining similar metals. And so then another type of way to join things is through soldering or brazing. And so then I could take either two pieces of steel or a piece of copper onto a piece of steel or whatever combination and actually melt silver or brass in between them. And that will act as kind of like a glue. So you're not bringing the two metals up to any sort of liquid temperature. That glue is coming up to a liquid temperature and fusing the two. But then what I'm most often doing is I'm doing some sort of inlay or overlay, and that's a completely mechanical connection. And so for inlay, you are removing material. I usually use a hammer and chisel and remove material and create some sort of undercut than a softer material can be pushed into. And so for woodworking terms, if you imagine it like a dovetail, if you look at it from the side, it looks like a dovetail. And so you're filling that undercut and the material won't come out.
Mm-hmm. Basically, it would be like, you know, whatever area you want to inlay, the walls that you're cutting out are angled back down into the material so that when you hammer it out, it fills in that and it can't pop back out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah.
And then there's a technique that I learned in Japan that I've been using more recently over the past few years that's kind of an overlay inlay technique where I use a very small chisel. It's called Nunome Zogon. And I use a small chisel and I hammer it along so it creates lots of chisel marks right next to each other. And you do that in multiple different directions. So kind of imagine it will end up looking like the face of a file. And then you can...
It's like push. A lot of like cross-hatching.
Yeah, it looks like cross-hatching. Yep. And you push softer metal into that. So then I'll take silver leaf, or not silver leaf, I'm sorry, silver foil or gold foil, which is thicker than leaf. And you push it into those teeth and the teeth grab it and hold on to it.
Whoa. So
that's another way of attaching.
That is so cool.
Wait, so the silver, the leaf is, is it like the glue that holds the two pieces together?
No, it's just the two. It is the two. So imagine if you had a file and the teeth on that file were soft. Mm-hmm. And then you took aluminum foil and pushed it down onto those teeth. At the same time you pushed down the aluminum foil, it would sink into those teeth, but those teeth would also start to collapse and hold it. So it's like Velcro. It's more like Velcro.
What?
Dang. Yeah, that's incredible. So, all right. Yeah. I think let me see if I understand this here. So you're, you know, causing, all right. So you're doing the little cross-hatching game and creating these deep shark fin-like channels or like file-like channels. And then you're laying another metal over that, like a thin sheet of metal.
A very thin foil or really thin wire. Like, I'll use like 30 gauge wire.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So super thin wire. And then you're laying that over it and then you're hammering that surface flat. And so what that does is it forces the soft or the very thin metal down into those grooves or little channels, but then it also closes those channels flat. And so they're pinching down where that like on the softer metals and stuff.
Yep.
Is that vaguely right?
Yeah. And it's a very sensitive procedure in terms of like, you're not hammering it in. You're actually I use these copper pushers. It's just like a wide copper wire and kind of pushing that material down. And then to affix it, you actually start by burnishing. And in the end, a lot of times I'll go over it with a very polished hammer to kind of make sure everything's really set.
Wow. That's insane.
it's a really fun meditative process. It's really nice. Wow. And it's really, the teeth can be really, I mean, they can be somewhat coarse, but they can also be very fine. Like almost when you feel it, it's almost like velvet. It's so fine.
Wow. Dang. I need to process that for
me. I know. I'm just like stopping and like thinking a little bit.
Computing.
It's not quite the same, but it sounds a little bit like this Swedish technique called coal rosing. I'm not completely sure how to say it. That the Vikings used to use. And you burnish the piece of wood and push all the fibers down and then go over it with a, like draw a design on it and then cut a line into the wood and then push a different, like cinnamon or something, like the dust from coffee, and push it into that line and then flap the piece of wood back over it and burnish it. And it's like, like a wood tattoo.
Wow. That sounds really beautiful.
Yeah. It's hard for me. It's not something I really do, but there are some really, really talented folks out there doing that. It's really interesting. Very interesting.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh man. so interesting. I love this stuff.
I guess I should just say that this technique, Nuno Bezogon, is just kind of the Japanese equivalent of, there's many different names for it in the world, including Damascene is probably the most common name it's called by, which is in Spain.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, cool. That's neat to see like the different techniques, you know, pop up all over the place that are or more or less the equivalent.
Totally. Yeah. It's cool because it's just different, you know, they're using slightly different tools, different finishes, different, you know, this or that, but it's the same concept.
And then each one of them say, this is the only way to do this.
Yeah.
And we're the only ones who do it. So this is a little bit kind of related, but did you feel in Japan, was there a barrier that you had to cross as a Westerner to kind of get into someone's shop? I know that as far as woodworking goes, it's been for a really long time, like pretty closed off. Like you have to be part of the tradition, and there's a lot surrounding that sort of cultural craft. So is that similar in metalsmithing and metalworking, forging stuff?
I mean, my experience, short answer is my experience was no, was that that everyone was extremely welcoming and open about what they did and how they did it. But I also had a really, a unique opportunity in that I was going with a Japanese woman, Hiroko, to these studios. She had already made the connection, said, I actually went the first time with a friend, Jack Mach, and then the second time with a woman named Yuri, who came along with us. And I shouldn't say she came along with us. She was hugely integral. She helped translate for me because I don't speak any Japanese, and she worked alongside me. She's an incredible jeweler. And I went there with native Japanese speakers, and Hiroko's from Japan originally, lives in Wisconsin now, has for many years now. But she made the introduction, said, I'm coming over with these American artists. Could we come see your studio? And so it was a little bit different than me just showing up, not speaking the language or speaking very little and saying, teach me how you do what you do.
Teach me all your secrets, please.
Yeah. No, that does seem like it would make a big difference.
And then when we like developed that relationship, because Hiroko hadn't met some of these people either. So then it was like three, almost 4 years later when I went back to study with these people. So it's like that relationship had come along in those years. So yeah, that's just my experience at least. I'm aware of what you're talking about.
That kind of
protectiveness, but I didn't experience that.
Well, that's nice. So why are you interested in locks? Like what? What's up with the locks? Do you have a lot of stuff you need to protect? Like
we found out he's like descended from a long line of pirates.
No. No, it's kind of, this was another thing that I found through like talking about the coffer to a lot of people that were coming through my studio. Was a lot of people would ask, oh, you must be really interested in security. and like, well, no, not really. And I guess the best way I can explain it is the lock just turns out to be a really, appropriate format for me to explore the techniques in the way of working that I like or that I'm interested in. So it kind of could be anything if it, involved pieces that I could forge and then refine and make fit together really accurately and and was a working thing in the end. So it's just kind of been a development, I guess, going back to like always challenging myself. It's like I learned to make a hammer. That was, you know, really exciting, making this functional thing that you could use. And then maybe a step up from that is a pair of dividers where it's a three-leaf pair of dividers that has a joint that has to work smoothly and hold tight when you need it to, but loose enough to move. And then from there would be like a door latch and then a simple door lock and then a multiple bolt door lock and then a coffer. You know, it's like just always kind of stepping it up and challenging myself.
Just a steady line of escalation.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Dang. So, yeah, because I know it. I see what you mean, though. That is a really nice thing where it's like each little component. I mean, when you look at pictures of your work, and I've had the fortune to see some of them in person. But it's like each component is like its own separate little like piece of art. But then when you put them all together, there's like a lot of like moving parts, and it's like very interactive and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it kind of like has that movement to it as well, even though like each piece is like a little stationary piece of metal at first, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you really mathematical? Are you like a mathematically brained person?
I wouldn't say that I'm not definitely not, but I'm probably far less than you might expect. there's very little measuring involved in that piece.
I can get behind that.
Or drawings for that matter. Like basically I did a drawing. I did a sketch in the beginning to make sure that, you know, when the bolt moved and the bolts, or when the, when the main bolt was thrown, that when the bolts moved, all the levers and things weren't going to run into each other. And after that, it was basically just like little sketches to decide, you know, maybe the design of this part or that. But then it was making samples and deciding how it looked, and then deciding to make 10 of those or whatever. Wow. So there's actually very few drawings that go along with it.
Cool. I was sorry. I just had, when you were just talking, like, oh, I just had this like picture of like a box. I was just like imagining you with a box of Crayola crayons and like, just like that was all your schematics.
Yep. That's so funny.
I'm sorry. I don't know what's wrong with my mind today.
I do. I mean, I really do enjoy drawing, and wish I kept better drawings, and wish I kept my drawing practice up more. Mm-hmm. But just I find that it's much more natural for me to work in three dimensions. Mm-hmm. I'd rather make a part three times to get the right one than do however many drawings and then still need to probably make it a few times.
Yeah.
Sounds like you just need the right book.
That sounds a little bit like you, Brian. You were saying how like you can't really draw, but you're making these really like cute and well-made tools for bookbinding that have little animals and feathers and all that sort of stuff that I think look like you draw them beforehand. Like, you know what I mean?
It's like, I mean, kind of like what Seth was saying, I very poorly doodle the basic design on the surface of the tool, and then I cut as closely as I can to the finished thing. But more often than not, I like kind of cut the outline, file the outline, and then I'll just start doodling with the graver and be like, oh, I like the way those shadow lines are. And then like, whoops, slipped again. And then I got to like file it back down and then redo it again. So I just like... I'm not a very good engraver, but I just am really stubborn. So I just keep at it and slowly hope that I'm getting better.
Well, you're relatively new to engraving, right?
Yeah. I took one like 5-day class, I think in the summer of 2018, and then bought a bunch of stuff and have been stumbling my way forward ever since.
I mean, it always amazes me to see the things that you learn, that one learns if practice enough, just come naturally, give it, you know, months or years or whatever. But I always, every once in a while, I kind of like think about what, and this isn't like a tooting my own horn. It's just that, oh, I've been doing this for so many years that these things come naturally and I don't have to think about them. And that feels really good.
Yeah.
And it's nice that when that comes, whether it be through design or process, it's just like at some point, you are going to know what mark looks good when you use that graver, you know, you'll screw it up enough times that you'll remember.
that's
all learning.
I haven't hit that limit yet. No, I think that's totally true though. And then it's nice too, because when you don't have to think about it, it makes space for like the new thing you're trying to figure out.
Yeah. I had a professor in college, a woodworking professor. And this is kind of along the same lines, is that this quote always stuck with me, was that he said, you're never going to get, and that's not totally, I don't totally agree with it, but that you'll never get better at making things. Maybe it wasn't this harsh. It was like, you'll get better at making things by getting better at fixing your mistakes.
Ooh, right? I like that.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like, you know, the better you are at knowing what not to do or when it does happen, how to fix that, then that's actually, you know, as educational or more educational than just getting it right every time.
Oh, that's a more positive version. That's a more positive version of a quote from one of my bookbinding teachers, which was, "The sign of a good bookbinder is just one who knows how to hide their mistakes."
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I think I might have put a more positive spin on that when I just said it. I think it's a little bit more direct, like that.
They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but who the hell are they? And anyways, I think the assessment of worth has no universal standard, which makes me miss the old days of gold, when what the dollar was based on had intrinsic value instead of our modern fiat funds of public faith. Another thing they say is time is money, except they there means one Benjamin Franklin. But time is far more valuable than money. I know what he means, but he could have gone a little further is all, and he's too dead to debate me. Which is actually a fact in favor of my argument. You can't pass the same second around in different time registers or sneak a counterfeit minute under anyone's nose. When you waste time, there's nothing you wasted it on collecting dust in your closet or garage. If someone takes some of yours, it's theirs forever. So on and so forth. And you know what else? Ben might get the street cred for this aphorism, but it's likely to have been around a lot longer than that. So the guy on our highest bill in circulation is kind of a thief in a way. Don't get me wrong, I'd take a hundo if you feel like sharing, but I want my paper to symbolize more dependability. And old Franklin might feel nice in the hands with its worn cotton, linen, and sense of wealth, but it can tear awfully easily. I want my paper to stretch and be durable, like Hanji, a Korean paper they say can last over 1,000 years. You can't see the 1,000 words in a picture. You can't live 1,000 years. And I still don't know who they are. Probably never will. But millennium-old evidence already exists of this paper made from a process involving pounding the inner bark of a mulberry tree into a pulp. Just as that tree relies on human cultivation for survival, the paper made from the tree relies on nature in the form of mucilage from a sunset hibiscus. Everything about Hanji is tied to long-lasting interactions rich with time, and Amy Lee has given her lifetime to it, making Hanji herself and many other things with it, from symbolic ducks she'll tell you about, to dresses, books, art exhibitions, icons, and more than enough to make one realize paper is capable of carrying its own meaning on its own in its fibers, without simply being something to write on or stand for. So I hope you take the time to check out our next episode with Amy. Thanks for spending this time with us, and thanks for allowing me to take this time, which is ending right now.
Seth, do you feel that craft and metalworking satisfies something in your life that you wouldn't get from another job or career profession?
I certainly hope so.
have you had a different job?
Probably a lot easier ways to make money. True. No, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of careers and jobs that would have overlap, especially if they're involve making something or working with your hands or even physical labor or problem solving. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess probably the, you know, most unique thing about being a metalsmith, metalworker, blacksmith, whatever, is working with metal. I think the material is really an incredible material that is really satisfying to work with. Mm-hmm. And I think something that one of my favorite parts about my shop and my field, my abilities, is that I can make anything that I need, any tool mm-hmm. that I need to make something, I can make mm-hmm. that tool. For the most part, not everything, of course.
Yeah, sure.
But that's a really, really rewarding thing, a very satisfying thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like it would be very handy.
So, it, like, not, I'm just as a comparison, like, what is the, why do would you prefer working with metal over wood? And this is not like, obviously, this is not to say like metal is better or something. It's just like, what is it about, you know, Seth that likes metal more than he likes wood?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, having worked with wood, not a ton. I'm not a woodworker, but I do like I turn my handles for certain for saws. I make handles for all of my hammers. I really haven't made much or any furniture, but knowing wood as a material a little bit, I won't compare it specifically to wood. I'll just talk about metal. I like that metal. I like that metal can, you can use it in a lot of different ways. It can be both a reductive process, an additive process, and then specifically the forging. You can't, there's no other material. I mean, clay is similar and glass is similar, but that you can forge, that you can manipulate mass in that same sort of way. So that's really exciting and interesting. And then its ability to be really functional in the way that it you can heat treat the material so that it can hold up as a hammer or keep a sharp edge as a knife. Yeah, I guess those are some of the qualities that are unique to it that I appreciate.
Yeah, that's cool. It's like, it's very versatile. Like, yeah, I can see that
and the,
additive
and
reductive.
That you can have with it. Like, I mean, wood is constantly moving. Metal moves too, just not as much.
Does metal has grain, right?
It's not like a wood grain. Like, it's more amalgamous than that, most metals. But there is, so wrought iron does have grain like wood. So wrought iron is a material that is no longer produced since there's newer technology was introduced for making steel, which is stronger. But wrought iron actually has a grain structure. So if you were to like score it and then bend it, it'll break. So you actually have to work with it in a little bit different way, which I use wrought iron a lot because it's really, I like the material. It's forge welds really nicely. It's softer when forging and softer when filing. It's just like a little bit different, interesting material to work with.
Do you have to make it yourself from, I guess, not wrought iron?
Do you have to
rot it yourself?
No. I would need a bloomery for that. I would need a steel plant or a iron. It's something that is, I use that as all salvage material.
Oh, okay. So, my question is, will you just, I'm just more for my own curiosity, would you explain sort of, many people might not know what the term like wrought iron means. And certainly by many people, I mean myself, but versus just like iron or whatever.
Sure. Well, iron is an ore. So iron is an element, is an ore, and that's what you dig out of the ground. And then it's how you process that depends on what kind of material you end up making. And so before steel was invented, and the process for making steel was invented, we had wrought iron, and that has, I'm not the best person to explain how all of this works and how all of it's made, but I'll stumble through it to entertain you.
Right on. That works.
And so wrought iron was made in a way that it has slag and impurities in it that get drawn out. And so that's that like kind of grain structure. And then it was, I want to say, in the mid 1800s when the Bessemer process was introduced or invented. And that that allowed people to make steel, which is basically a totally amalgamous material. So there's no grain to it. It's all the same all the way through, which makes it stronger. So for structural components, think about a skyscraper, a bridge, or whatever. You know, you want the strongest material possible for that. And so steel came into the picture, and in time, wrought iron quit being produced at all. And then when you talk about steel, you're talking about iron with a bunch of other stuff in it. The simplest and largest part being carbon. And I listened, you had Will on, and so I'm sure that you talked about like carbon and heat treating and stuff like that, but it's depending on how much carbon you have in it, makes it a different material. And the more carbon, kind of the for the simplicity's sake, the like sharper a knife could be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but then also like the more brittle, if I'm remembering correctly,
and that all gets into a whole like heat treating conversation, which we can have, but
no.
You probably had a better one as well.
No, we did talk about it a little bit with Will. So if anyone's interested more in learning about heat treating, you can check out our episode 1 with Will Manny.
Yeah. So, I mean, talking about Will, he mentioned that there was a tension between forging with coal or with gas. Is that... like within the blacksmithing community, it was like, oh, you're a coal forger or a gas forger. How does that play out for you? Is there like a side to pick?
About it, no. Either way is fine with me. No, either way is fine with me with what you do. It all depends on what you're trying to do. I hear what he's saying in terms of, like any field, there's, that's like a whole conversation that I don't really want to get into.
Okay.
It's more akin to like gossip, you know? It's like,
right. Yeah.
For whatever reason. But from a practical sense, I primarily forge in coal, like 95 to 99% of the coal I have. 95 to 95. Oh, I can't speak. I guess I am getting tense. Jeez.
It's a very sensitive topic.
Yeah, 95 to 99% of the time I'm using my coal forge because it allows me to take really high heats on really specific parts of the metal, whether I'm doing forge welding or if I just need to heat up one part of a pair of dividers to forge out the legs. I just want to heat that up, not the rest of it, so that it gets all scaled and crusty and things like that. Whereas a gas forge, it's great because it's all the same heat all the way through the gas forge, but that means that it's all the same heat all the way through the gas forge. Right. Up to the same temperature at the same time. So it's they're different tools, essentially.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah.
And it also depends, like, is your shop in the city? Like, you might not be able to have a coal forge in the city.
Oh, yeah.
I'm out in the country in the mountains. It's no problem out here. But it would be very inefficient to do most of the work that I do in a gas forge.
Right. Okay. No, that's cool. That's a super helpful, like practical explanation of the difference between the two. It's not just like a lifestyle choice or anything. Like it's a very you can get a lot more specific with coal because you can just put that part of the tool in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to lie, I really enjoy the coal forge. I'd much rather work with the coal forge than the gas forge. But that's a lot of my studio practices. I try and err on the side of doing things that I enjoy doing and not not doing things specifically because I think that they're going to be way faster or I don't know. You know, I'd rather spend a little bit longer doing something that I enjoy than shaving off a little bit of time and not enjoying what I'm doing.
Sure.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, I like that too. Approved. So who's someone inside of metalworking that you admire? And then maybe someone outside of your craft that you admire?
I had an opportunity to work with a lot of different people over the course of my time at Penland because I was actually there as a core fellow for 2 years. So that was where I got to take classes at Penland and then later on came back as a resident. But I got to work with a lot of different people. And man, there are so many people inside the craft that I respect and admire. It's hard to choose one, but I guess Peter Ross, he's a huge influence for me and helped me really look at what I do in a different way and help show me the way to do things that turns out I really enjoy. So Peter was the master blacksmith at Colonial Williamsburg for 25 years. And so he's probably, if not the way high up there, foremost knowledge of colonial ironwork. And so he works very traditionally and historically. And his understanding of blacksmithing and forging is just was much different than I was exposed to up until meeting him. Working more with your hands, working really efficiently at the forge, forging things really close to their finished product, mm-hmm. and then bringing them to the bench and refining them with files and showing mm-hmm. me what like really beautiful file work looks like.
Wow, cool.
And just to see the objects that he was able to make, which were reproductions of historical objects, mm-hmm. seeing what he was able to make simply with a coal forge, a hammer, an anvil, and a bench vise and a file was just totally eye-opening to me.
So before that, what were you doing? Like if he transformed your thoughts about that, like were you not forging as precisely before you started filing? Like
I mean, when I met him, I was still very pretty new to blacksmithing. Like had been interested in it for maybe 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. and at that point had gotten to take classes at Pentland with a lot of people, and just through starting to get to know the community, the prevalent kind of model is like, how do I describe this? It has a lot more to do with power tools. It has a lot to do with, you know, basically it's, you know, gas forges, it's production shops. It's gas forges with power hammers, with steel floors and metal buildings and mm-hmm. lots of grinding, all those things. That's what I thought blacksmithing was. And a lot of architectural work. That's what I saw most people doing. But then mm-hmm. working with Peter, it was also the first time I got to work with someone who made a lock similar to what I had seen in Rouen, France. And like getting to see him in his home shop. He's not at Williamsburg anymore. He's got a shop in Eastern North Carolina. And it's mm-hmm. got... it's a wooden shop. It's just got a single coal forge in it. It's got a nice big wooden bench in it. Most of it is wood, not concrete and steel. It's just like a different, softer environment that I really appreciated. While also being, he was making work that was more precise than that other type of work.
That's interesting.
So it's like, and the way that he understands the material and think and thought about it, like I was saying, you know, forging it as close to finish as possible. I've known Peter long enough and gotten to now both work with him in his shop, taken classes with him, taught classes with him. Like I've and also know people who have done that as well. There's always something, you know, he's always got these, he'll say something that you just like blows your mind. And one that comes to mind is as a little preface is that scale, when you forge the steel oxidizes and you get scale on the surface. And that's a really hard thing that you have to either grind off or you can use like a mild acid to etch it off. And so when you go to file it, that can be really difficult to work with because it can actually dull your files. And so I was working with Peter one time in a class, someone asked, you know, like, well, how do you deal with scale? You don't use a wire brush and brush it off or grind it off or anything? He's like, oh, well, I just forge it so it doesn't have scale on it.
Whoa.
And your mind like blew up.
Like what he means is that he forages aggressively at a high temperature when the metal's scaling. So the scale falls off. And then as it's cooling down, that's when you're doing refining heat so that it's no longer scaling anymore. You can refine the surfaces. So it's like he works in such a way that the material, you know, he works with the material. He doesn't try and force the material to do something else. And so I think his insight through studying historical work and figuring out how it was made, you know, that type of working really opened to my eyes to a more enjoyable way of working in the shop. And I'm still, I can't hardly do that. Like, that's really tough. But I got, you know.
It's like Someone asks him a question and he's like, oh, I just bend it with my mind. Like,
yeah, there's definitely some of that.
Oh, that's great. Oh, yeah. What about outside?
Outside of metalsmithing or outside of craft,
yeah,
period?
Just, well, whatever. Either I mean, like, it's just kind of a general question to get people thinking like outside of.
That there is life outside.
Yeah, no, there's definitely life outside craft. And so like in like talking about that specifically, I guess I really admire my wife. She's aww, a nurse. And
oh wow.
That,
yeah.
Like that's a lot different than what we do. Like a lot different. And it's a really nice reminder of what the rest of the world, especially right now, what everyone
yeah, really.
With.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah, more and more I admire her and what she does.
Oh,
cool.
That's nice. I like that.
Yeah. My mom's a nurse and she's a badass and I love her.
It's a really incredible, intense, man, add in a lot of different adjectives field.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. we had someone, Tim Manny, on the show several episodes ago, and he, the person that he admired outside the field, which I still think about all the time, is was a gait specialist who it was like they focused on how you like hold your body and walk around and stuff like that so that you can like not be so hard on yourself.
Not an iron gait.
No. Oh, we see where your mind is.
Yeah.
Get your mind out of the forge, Seth. no. Yeah. Sorry. G-A-I-T specialist. And I just thought that was really interesting that it was like sometimes it's nice. What I'm trying to say is it's important to remind myself, and hopefully some listeners can relate to this, that like, yes, there are things outside of what we do. Like, it's not like what we do as a craftsperson has to identify us all the time.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's really healthy to not be totally absorbed in this world.
What? That's, I don't, that doesn't make any sense.
We just hear the door close on Amy's.
Yeah. I'm just like, I'm done.
Sorry.
No. That's just my persona. We have a good cop, bad cop persona.
I'm the
like hardliner.
I'm the one that's like, oh, I'm real personable. Now tell me what I need to know.
Tell me more about Nuno Mezogon.
Oh. So outside of the craft you're in now, what else are you interested in?
Well, in terms of like in the shop, things that I'm interested in, I've been really fascinated by clockmaking. It's something that I would love to pursue at some point, but yeah. It's like a whole world, you know, it's a whole nother craft, even though they're made out of metal. It's like a completely different thing. I think that stuff's absolutely fascinating. And I would love to, I'd love to like, well, first of all, make a clock and then incorporate that into my work somehow. But that's probably still a few years down the road.
Like a time released lock.
Totally, yeah. Oh. Yeah. There's like a history of time locks for bank vaults.
Whoa, cool.
Yeah.
Really, you know, want to make a time lock per se, but like the idea of having stored energy in my work, I think is really appealing. And along those lines, it's like, I don't know if you know anything about like automatons and things like that, but that's like a whole nother world that is basically clock making, but for not clocks.
But for like trying to make like a little person move around.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so I think all of that stuff could be really interesting and dovetail nicely with locks and boxes and things like that.
So, I mean, based off your aesthetic and some of the pieces that, you know, some of these other pieces that, or most of the tools and stuff, is most of your stuff inspired by like 18th and 19th century metalsmithing?
Yeah, I definitely am. I'm very inspired by historical work. You know, usually if I'm making a new piece, it's based off of, well, for example, the last kind of large piece I made, called an indicator lock, And it's a lock that when you unlock it, there's a pattern done in 24 karat gold, Nuno Mezogon, that's a very geometric pattern that shifts when you unlock the lock. And if you don't relock it and then know how to relock it properly, then the pattern will stay skewed. And so it'll indicate that the lock has been opened. And that's based off of these locks that I've seen several examples of that have some sort of indication that the lock was used, whether it be a dial that counts the number of times it's been opened, or there's several different ones. So it was kind of, I wasn't remaking any of those, but that's what sparked my interest in making something like that.
Wow.
Cool. That's really, really neat.
That is cool.
So we got clock making. Is there, and I guess related exploits, is there anything like, I don't know, walks on the beach or like making homemade pasta or
both of those, definitely into those. I'm not very close to a beach, so that's kind of, it's a long walk to the beach. I am not a chef by any means, but I love cooking. Both my wife and I love cooking a lot. Enjoy food in general. We have a nice garden, we have chickens, so there's like a lot of stuff to do at home that's interesting and fun.
Cool.
Getting into riding my bike more, which has been really nice. It was actually really fun a few years ago when I was at Penland as a resident. You get one free class to take, and so I got to take a bike frame building class. So I built this touring bike frame and finally got it built up, and so now I've started getting to ride it a bit more.
That's awesome.
That's kind of a fun outside the shop, inside the shop activity too, because there's always like little, like making brake hangers or like racks or whatever else that I can make in the shop, but then get to just make it for the bike.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And not sign it and not worry about it.
You're right.
No, it just reminds me of like if there was some kind of leather work or something, then like, yeah, so then I got to take a like a running shoe making class, and they just like, so now I go running in those.
Oh yeah. Do you it left. It's gone. Question is gone.
Incidentally, I do.
I do.
Oh, man. Okay. All right. Back on track here. So if someone wants to see more of your work, how can they find you?
My website is probably the best place to find me, and that is sethgould.com. Okay. And then I also try and keep up somewhat of an Instagram presence. And so that's at Seth Gould.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah. No, thanks for joining us. It was great talking with you.
Oh, thank you guys. This has been fun.
Okay. So next up, we have an interview with papermaker and artist Amy Lee. And in case you need a chance to size up our conversation, that's a papermaking pun.
No. I didn't get it.
That's what
at
I
all.
Got. It's really funny to a very small number of people. But anyway, yeah, here's a brief clip from that interview.
The first time I was trying to make one, I was actually teaching at Penland. So they encourage teachers to work on creative work while the students are doing the same. And I'm working on this duck, and I started from the head, and I'm going down. And one of my students said, Amy, have you ever seen a real duck?
Alrighty, Humble, what do we got?
Please feel free to hit like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on, I don't know, a huge list of podcast platforms. So it makes a really big difference when you review us and rate it, because it helps with the show's visibility. Thanks for everyone's support on Patreon. It helps us pay for regular website subscriptions, maintenance, and hosting, and all that kind of stuff. And if we get more support, we can dedicate time to different side projects and more interviews per month. So we are so, so thankful for everyone who's supporting us on Patreon, and we'd like to encourage anyone who's on the fence about that to go ahead and maybe look at it.
Yes. That's so good.
No pressure.
Just look at it. Take a look at it.
Just take a look.
No.
It'll be harmless, I promise.
No, yeah. Thank you so much to everyone who has done that. It really does. Though this may seem glamorous, it's just two of us like sitting in our PJs in our own houses talking to people over the internet.
There are a lot of like sweatpants involved.
Yeah.
And hard work.
Go Steelers, right, Amy?
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so you can follow us on Instagram at Cut the Craft Podcast to see images of the work, to hear little snippets from interviews. It helps you stay up to date on what's happening, the releases, side projects, everything. So if you haven't already, go ahead and like us on Instagram. And if you're interested in our personal accounts, mine is at Amy_Umble and Brian's is at BH Beidler.
As always, thanks to the people who help continue to make this show possible. In particular, thank you to Brad Vetter for your graphic design. Mm-hmm. To the High Divers for your music, and in particular to Luke Mitchell of the High Divers for helping us out with some of the mastering on the back end of things. Mm-hmm. And then also to Justin Williams, who writes those commercial tidbits that introduce each guest every week. So we hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we did making it. Thanks.
See you next time.